Well, I think I should say first.
I wish I'd gotten that about your mother. That's a very. Could you say some of that over?
Oh,
about
yes.
Your,
oh, yes. I suppose my earliest political conditioning came from a very religious mother who was not political in any sense that most of us would recognize, but who constantly imbued her sons with the notion that they should not act or be as though anything were too menial for them. They should fit into situations and they should do what was normal there. And she also told me about my education. She said that the people paid for it, and I was going to have a good education, which my parents could not have paid for it, but that I must not use what I gained from the education against the people. Now, when one speaks about the people, there are various sophists who want to know what he is talking about. Seems to me that the people are a many-armed assemblage. They are an assemblage because they are comprised of individuals and because they have associated for one or more purposes, or to secure the very existence of life. They are many-armed in the literal sense, having many arms, many people, but they are many-armed in the means by which they seek to achieve the purposes of their assemblage. When I talk about political action and about the means of forming or launching third parties or independent political associations, I'm going to do it only in the terms of a context, an assemblage of people having purposes, purposes which are related to the needs they feel in their time. I'm not going to talk only of candidates, for the candidates are one of the means by which persons in a political assemblage choose or may arrive at some of their objectives. And I'm not going to talk only about political activities, because anybody who would refuse to acknowledge the powerful impact of street demonstrations on the course of events in this society would be quite mistaken. And anybody who would fail to acknowledge the powerful impact of trade union actions upon the course of the society would be profoundly mistaken. If I choose to accent only the political, it is because I'm not speaking today as though I were writing a volume of 3,000 pages, but I choose to speak on one aspect. But I ought to point out, I think, to those who question political action, or rather who question economic action, that there was last year or the year before in San Francisco a strike of 176 people. They were members of the Mailers Union. This cut all of San Francisco's newspapers from the scene. Can any 176 of you, young or old, stop the media communication in any given city? You cannot. Could these 176 people by themselves change the political characteristics of San Francisco? They could not. So my point really is that we have to have a variety of means suitable to our many arms in this assemblage. Some of them are economic, some of them are demonstrative, and some of them are political. Now, the odd thing about the political enterprise is that you can step forth and win your fight for trade union wages or for improvement in the schools and gain some conditions.
Can I interrupt you just?
Yeah. Now, it seems to me that one must consider issues of this kind. Suppose that one has put on a strong demonstration at a university or a well-waged strike in the economic field, and has won advantages from it. Those advantages in the economic field can be taken away by an increase in prices, and those in the academic or other field can be taken away by some action of the region, so by some general police action. These latter actions are political actions. their actions taken by the political authorities who are in charge of the rules and regulations of the state. So that it's not enough to fight only on the street front and on the picket line, one must also fight on the political line. And I think this is quite important for us to realize. But let me emphasize again, I would not say that our problems can all be solved only by taking political action. We must take the other forms of action too. Now, there are two kinds of political actions, roughly speaking. There is the kind in which one becomes part of an existing political structure. He starts out like a precinct committeeman at the bottom, and he works up and he becomes a member of the committees at the top, and maybe he runs for the state legislature and gets elected. Maybe he runs for the city council and gets elected, as I did when I was 27 years old, back in those days when the young people were taking the brunt of the fight against the Depression.
You were elected?
Yes. Oh. Elected to the city council in Seattle, Washington. I was 27 years old. Candidate of labor and of the intellectuals. It was a common front of the Workers' Alliance at the base, of the unemployed people, of the working people, and of the liberal intellectuals in the town. And we fought and won this battle.
What year was that?
That was 1937. And it was on a program of economic demands for people. Also, I injected into the city council race an anti-fascist content, fighting against fascism and fighting against the threats of war, which were imminent in those days. And so I mentioned this only because I wish to say that when a person is a candidate for a popular group, for a broad mass of people, having the character that I mentioned, he shouldn't restrict himself only to the little narrow duties of the office for which he is running. He should say, all right, I'm going to be for good government, I'm going to take a good stand on all these local issues of which I'm running. But I also wish to say that people in this position ought to function, even if they're small leaders, as leaders of opinions. And my opinions are of anti-fascist and an anti-war nature, and my opinions are so and so. And this is the way I think that a person running for office, whether he's in or out of an old political party, ought to conduct himself in order to be in some measure a spokesman for the issues that are agitating the people of his time. Now, you can work then, as I was saying, in two definite ways. You can work inside the old political structure and work your way on up. And this has its advantages, because there is a structure that you're working with. But its disadvantage is that one is constantly forced to make a decision. The decision being whether he should stick with this organization at this time on this issue, and thus compromise his ultimate convictions, or whether he should fight the organization. Now, I was elected to Congress in 1944, and in 46, I had a very difficult time because I found that it was necessary for me to fight the anti-labor policies of President Truman. And yet I was running for office in the Democratic primaries. And this was a problem. I fought them. And of course I was defeated. So this is the kind of thing that happens. It happens when you take issue with the organization which you're part. This does not mean that you should not take the issue. And it does not mean that you might not wish to conduct your political activities within an old established structure. However, in 1948, I decided to go with the Progressive Party, which was then supporting Henry Wallace for president. Seemed to me I'd tried the other route and I'd try this new one. And so out I went, and I was a national field organizer for that party, one of them. First, let us say that the principles of that party, the prime motivation of that party, was to carry on the best of the Roosevelt traditions. These had to do with the economic intervention by the government of the United States into the economic system to force it to produce some small values for the unemployed people and for the houseless people and for the hungry people in the land. We did win some small commitments in that direction. Its second major thing was its outlook toward world peace, its commitment through Roosevelt and the meetings of the high figures in the world to a lasting, a just and lasting peace to have been pursued through equality of nations in a new organization, the United Nations. We firmly believed in those principles, and we felt that the coalition which won the war in World War II, I guess we did win it, at least we won its military objectives, World War II, could be continued into a new world. Truman, we saw, was working with the Cold War forces and would involve a split in this basic coalition of nations which we hoped might be developed. If this was not Roosevelt's full purpose, it was our purpose in supporting Roosevelt, and it was our purpose in launching the new party to pursue these purposes. Henry Wallace split with the Truman administration at verge of the opening of its attack on the solidarity between the United States and the Soviet Union. And in the long run, this hostility between the United States and the Soviet Union extended to the overbearing of the British and the French by American imperialism too, but that's another story. At any rate, we launched this party. Now, there are other things that might be said about this. The party cannot succeed, a third party cannot succeed or be an effective challenge unless it has wide support among the working people. It must have other support too, but that's one huge section. It must have wide support among the ethnic groupings in the country, the powerful black community and the powerful, I don't know how to, I suppose persons of Spanish descent, one ought to say. We often refer to them as Chicanos in California. But this large grouping too must be involved.
And women.
Yes, and women.
They're going to be a powerful.
Yes. I bet. Oh, all right. Now, we didn't have means to approach all these people in those days. We had some backing from labor, parts of the organized labor movement, mostly the lower echelon officers and rank and file members in steel and rubber, and generally in what was then the CIO, there was some support, and we worked very hard promoting candidates. We sought for a new definition of what should you call it, majority representation.
That's just what's happening now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Nobody knows who this majority is.
Yeah, well, we were trying to get, we got black candidates to run in various districts for Congress.
You did.
And in St. Louis, where I worked for a while, we had, in other places, we had black candidates running. We were trying very hard in those days by methods which I think, if you look back upon them, were probably superficial, because we were early trying to pick out the best black person that we could find, we could think of the run. We were trying to tell those black people who would be their best representative.
Mm-hmm.
We did get over that a little bit toward the end of our party, which came about 1952. We began to urge blacks to gather together to put up their own candidate whom we pledged to support. We did learn a little, but we were trying to get this coalition together. However, I won't go into all that either, because that also is a matter of historical study. What I think might be interesting is the means by which we got this party started. There was a great deal of volunteer work done, had to be. There wasn't money to pay for all this. The question was, how does one get on the ballot? Well, you get on the ballot in a variety of ways. Sometimes you support a person who was on, say, the Democratic or Republican ticket, who would pledge to common tactics. That's a curious way to start a new party. But it's one way of doing, because what you're really trying to do is gather people around a common banner, and that banner is composed of issues. And if there's a candidate in the old party who stands pretty much for the issues, why would you run him down because he has a different name, because he's called a Republican or called a Democrat instead of being called a progressive? You should not do that. You should launch your own stand with your own candidates. Now then, that is done by getting on the ballot. And many young people today are quite familiar with that process. It often takes petitions. And in the initiatives in California, young people have been out to modify the character of the laws with petitions. So you know very well, most young people know very well, how this is done. You have to get a large group of people together and get them out and get the signatures of valid registered voters. And it has to be through a certain number. And you're almost always certain that the people who count these petitions will give you the wrong end of the count if they have any chance to do so. So you have to get at least a third more, maybe a half more, than the number of signatures that you're legally required to get. Sometimes you have to do this in different states like Ohio, which is very difficult. You have to pick up a certain percentage of the voter. I think it's 10%, if I remember correctly. 10% of the amount of votes which the governor who won the last election got when he ran. Well, no, this could be something like 350,000 valid votes that you have, to pick up. And to gain that, you have to get something like 700,000 to make sure. And then you have to get them in the different counties. I mean, you can't just get them in one spot. Out of 88 counties, you have to get them in 40. And that means you have to go out in the country where you really have to beg and plead with people to give them a chance to let your man run, because lots of them don't even understand. Well, I don't want to run their intelligence down, obviously, but they haven't been exposed to the same issues in the countryside as many cities people have been. And if you take a city program to the countryside, people don't understand you as quickly, or they just don't want to.
That's a big problem in Minnesota now.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure.
The farm vote controls it now because of the old Republican farm majority, which doesn't exist anymore.
Well, in every city, every state, there's some kind of problem like this. Now, there's another way of going about this, and that is, many states, I don't know how many now, many states, all you do to start a new party is to hold a primary, hold a convention on primary day, and then you gather whatever number of delegates together, or people together for that assembly on that primary day, general primary day, that the law says you have to have. In Nebraska, it used to be 110, and someplace else, in the state of Washington, it used to be 25. I think it's 100 now.
Was all this true in the 1896 in the Populist Party? Was this inaugurated afterwards, or did the Populist Party have to get on the ballot that way?
You think that it was easier. But they must have
made those laws after the...
Well, the Ohio law was made tough because in 1924,
La Follette ran,
and he carried the city of Cleveland.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's a big industrial city. Tough. And then the legislature got together and they made the laws tough.
It was against the third party.
It was against the third party that these laws had been made tough.
Is there any easy way to get rid of them?
Election laws are enacted by state legislatures, and you either have to get them thrown out by the court or start an initiative, a referendum of some sort, and then vote on it or take it to the legislature. Mm-hmm. The courts at the present time, I don't know how long this is going to last, but at the present time the courts have been fairly useful on this notion of one man, one vote, and it's fairly possible that might be inaugurated. But let me tell you a thing the way we did in the state of Washington with the Progressive Party. Because this might meet the needs of many people who are working today. We organized the convention to found this party, and we set out to get delegates. We didn't want just people there. Now, this may seem to sound strange. You don't want just people. But a delegate is a person who represents people. So when you talk to a delegate, you're supposed to be talking to 20 people or 2,000 people if he's a proper leader of them. And so what we did was to mimeograph sheets, and on top of this mimeograph sheet it says, we, the undersigned registered voters of such and such county, view the formation of a new party, the Progressive Party, as a valuable thing in this state, and we choose as our delegate to this party, blank, Smith, or whatever his name would be, which would be written in. Now this was all there was to it. And so, whoever wanted to go to this convention was given a slip. And he was supposed to go out to his neighbors or in his trade union group or his shop or wherever he had any collection of people that he had influence with and get them to sign to send him and put a dollar in. And this dollar went to finance the whole apparatus.
Oh, that's good.
So, you know, that's a very simple thing. Mm-hmm. It meant that each person would get, you were supposed to have 20, each person get 20 persons, $20, and have the And he was expected to come back from the convention and get his 20 people together and tell them what happened and organize a club.
Mm-hmm.
You see? So there you got the whole organizational procedure broken down into a nutshell. Mm-hmm. And we have found, I think everybody's found, that if you're going to be effective, you can't be effective in general. You have to be effective specifically. And that specifically means in a neighborhood, or it means in a shop where people work. It means in some, or a farm, it means in some place where there are people you have to be effective. And this means you have to have an organization of some sort in those areas. So that getting these 20 people together and forming a club like this was one basis of our operation. Now, I think the last thing I want to offer on this, although I'm pleased to respond to any questions, but the last thing I want to offer on this is that this cannot be done in the upper atmosphere. One cannot say, well, now is the time. I mean, a people of 10 or 12 people, or one person, or 200 from across the nation, cannot say, now is the time for a third party, and we are going to start it. Well, of course they could say it if they want to. But this determination has to be a determination by people, in the broad sense, that the founding of a new political party like this must measure up to what many of them want, and many of them are committed to, and many of them will take part in, and many of them will work for. In other words, you can't launch it because you want it. You have to launch it only when there is a variety of people to whom it seems a natural.
Do you feel that the 48 campaign had that necessity, or was it from the top, sort of, or was it?
It's hard to answer that. We had powerful support at the bottom because, you know, since 1932, we've been working across the country, many of us, and in our states, building up and maintaining a rather large popular organization.
Since 32, that's...
Well, the Depression.
I think that's important, that they don't just come up miraculously.
Yes. Now, we felt it was a mistake, though weren't any of us strong enough, able enough, to prevent it. We thought it was a mistake not to have developed a New Deal party, if you like, a party committed to the best of the elements of Roosevelt while he was in there. And of course, there were some such parties in existence. There was the American Labor Party in Minnesota, there was the Farmer Labor Party, and then the Farmer Labor Democratic Party. And then our state, we had the Washington Commonwealth Federation, and there were other things like this, but there was no coalesced movement. We coalesced this, frankly speaking, as a defensive structure. We didn't believe we could win, but we felt that we had to fight the Third World War, which was being organized by the administration, so we felt, and by the Cold War forces in the land.
Well, it was true. I mean,
Yes. Churchill spoke, Fulton, Missouri, and they proclaimed the Cold War right there. And we felt we were fighting this, and we were going to assert what we could of the best of the traditions past and assemble the best vanguard we could from around us, and we were going to fight this. We feel that we represented the will of many people. We did not represent the will of the majority of the people, but we represented the will of many people, and, well, again, I won't reflect on whether... The Washington Commonwealth, the Federation.
Did that go on as an educational... join it? I mean, was it something like you joined and stayed in it, or...
No, it wasn't exactly
you just voted
like that. It was a federation... Well, it's another interesting way of establishing a political organization independent of existing parties. This wasn't a party. What it was a federation of affiliates. And these affiliates could be trade unions, they could be Grangers. We had some Grangers in the organization.
The organization joined it.
And we had senior citizens, we had the Washington Pension Union, and its members joined it. And all kinds of groups, the unemployed, the Workers' Alliance joined it. All these different groups joined it. And then the Executive Council was... We would have a convention every year at which delegates came and formulated policy. And then we would have an executive committee, which was composed of representatives of these various groups, so that we were trying to maintain a foundation for political independent action. We chose to exert our independence in the Democratic primaries, although we once or twice reminded the Democrats that we were quite prepared to join in the Republican Party if we had to, because we were combined for principles and not for partisan loyalty. We could move as we chose. And we did run an independent candidate or two in some spots where the primaries came out not to our liking.
Well, that's an important form for now, isn't it? I mean, it's just a continuation. Yeah. How many, do you have any way of knowing how many belong to that at one at
well,
its height?
You can't say exactly, but when I was defeated for the city council
in 1940,
for the city council in Seattle. You see, now this is just one place where we had strength, was in Seattle. I was defeated with 41,000 votes. Now, that fact, when a winner got something like 50, I mean, he was 9,000 votes ahead of me, that fact was enough, the fact that I was defeated with so large a number was enough to terrify the people around me. In other words, I was licked. But look at the large body of people who were involved. And while these were not members of our organization, they were people who did follow what we stood for. So that, and that's always a very, and now that's a good tactic. That and this whole business of organizing by petition. Now, I think I need to say that what's quite important about this is that the individual candidate is in some sense quite important, in a considerable sense very important, because he has to be articulate and he has to say what he ought to be saying. But nobody, no candidate, should be dependent on. And one thing that turns people off politics is they always claim, and it's often true, that you elect a man who's a good man. He's your neighbor, he's your friend, he's something. And you put him in Congress, you put him someplace else, and then pretty soon he isn't doing anything at all.
Well, you abandon him there, too.
That's right.
I mean, you really don't press him
or support him. That's right. The people tend to vote on election day and forget the thing in between. Uh-huh. But then it isn't the people's fault primarily. What really is involved here is that most of us approach politics as being, oh, I'm a McGovernite, I'm a Muscatite, I'm a DeLaceyite, I'm this or that or the other thing. Well, we are not ites of any kind. You know what? The only reason we ought to join any of these movements is because a large number of people of roughly what shall I say, good people, are there, and we want to talk to these good people, and we want to try to hold all this bunch of people together in some sort of assemblage, which is of a larger moment than the candidate who has brought us together. And so I like to say to McGovern, you know. I believe he's the best candidate running, but gee, I would hate to leave this country in the hands of him or anybody else. I mean, even Roosevelt. Well, we didn't care to leave the country in the hands of only Roosevelt. We were constantly having demonstrations and constantly sending delegations to Washington to see our congressmen and whatnot and keep the fire stirred up. You don't keep the fire stirred up under any politician, no matter how good he is. He's bound to get a little bit slow. He's a fool, in fact, to act very far ahead of where the people can be rallied.
Well, he's also a tool of the powers when he gets in there.
Yes. He's curbed on every respect.
It was an interesting thing that I think Baldwin, many years ago, was writing about the New Deal, and he was astonished how many of the laws came from the third party, North Dakota, they used the Social Security law that was written by the farmers in 1918.
Oh, is that so? I didn't know that either.
Yeah, and you know, all that education and all that power and know-how and was used, the unemployed law came from North Dakota. And I mean, all that really educated the people and made them an instrument.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was I don't think there's any study of that.
I've frequently heard it said about these things, you know, you're speaking of movements. I've frequently heard it said about these things that you can't trust the people if they won't stay together.
Uh-huh.
You know, this really doesn't make very much sense. Does anyone expect that he could set out and in a few short hours or days or years amalgamate together an association so firm that no member of it would ever, for any reason whatsoever, drop away? I mean, this is perfectly ridiculous. All these movements are like eddies. They have a pulse to them. But it's a but there's a forward and there's a backward movement in them. And you
well, you have to count on the power of the enemy.
Indeed.
I mean, they'll do anything to smash those two parties. I think that's something you ought to say something about.
Yes, that's right.
I mean, what now in the, on the range, they spent $1 million to defeat Johnny Bernard, for example.
There's a great deal of money spent in my district to defeat me when I was running for re-election to Congress, too. We thought 200